KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Patterson, California.
I live in Richmond.
I live in Daly City, top of the hill, Daly City.
Noe Valley.
San Francisco, Outer Mission.
I live in San Pablo, California.
Coming up, Oakland residents grieving the murder of Mia Wilson turn to art and spiritual spaces.
Each breath cries, say her name.
Then we'll head north to the kelp forest collapse that's closed the nation's largest recreational abalone fishery.
I got a lot of friends that are business owners in town, and they're all definitely feeling it.
And we'll see who got top dog at the World Dog Surfing Championships.
We pushed her into a wave, and she had a great time. So we did it again, and it was the most confident I had ever seen her.
Stay tuned, Cross Currents is next. It's been almost a month since Nia Wilson, an African-American teenager, was fatally stabbed at an Oakland BART station by a white man. The Wilson family's attorneys recently filed a claim against BART and are prepared to sue. As the community continues to grieve, some residents feel this was not a random attack, but a hate crime. Others disagree. Here to talk about that and how the community has come together to heal is KALW's Oakland reporter, Janae Darden. Hey, Janae.
Hi, Hannah.
So, such a sad story we're all following. A lot has happened over the month.
Yeah, really a lot has happened. The Alameda County District Attorney's Office, they filed charges against John Lee Cal. One charge is for murder of Nia Wilson, and the other is attempted murder of her sister, Latifah, who was also stabbed. Mm-hmm. Now, he's facing life sentences with those charges, and he has prior felony convictions that could double the life terms because of the three strikes law in California.
Mm-hmm.
And attorneys for the Wilson family announced on Friday that they filed a claim against BART. And they said they've spoken to two women who alleged Cal threatened them at BART days before the murder. Now, one woman said he made a gesture like sliding his finger across his neck.
Like slitting your throat.
And another woman said he brandished a knife on the train. Now, they tried to report him, but there were no station agents at the booths.
No station agents.
No. So I contacted the law firm and asked about the races of these two women, and they haven't gotten back to me yet.
Okay. So he is facing serious charges. He's supposed to be back in court this week to enter a plea. But you're saying some Oakland residents don't think that that is enough. These charges are not enough.
No, some Oakland residents, especially in the Black community, say he should also be charged with a hate crime. But so far, the DA has said they haven't found any evidence that this was a hate crime. Mm-hmm. They have put together a special team to investigate for any evidence of a hate crime. And they said if they find any evidence, then they will include that charge against him.
So why do people think this is a hate crime?
Well, some people think the murder is racially motivated. You know, there have been a slew of stories about racial tensions escalating in Oakland, especially as it relates to gentrification. And I don't know if you saw that video that went viral of a white woman in East Oakland threatening to call the police on a Latino family for parking on the street.
Yes.
And they were she was asking them, where are you from? You know, where are you from?
Mm-hmm.
And there have been reports of new residents calling the police on Black churches, playing music on Sunday mornings. And these Black churches have been in the community for decades.
Right.
People are tense from the wave of racial violence across the country targeting African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of witnesses who saw John Lee Cal on the BART train the day he was taken into custody noticed that he focused his attention on the Black female passengers.
Interesting.
Yeah. And one witness, a Black woman, told NBC News that she saw him staring at other Black women with his hands down his pants. So some people think he was targeting Black women in his attack.
Okay, but still not everyone thinks this is a hate crime, right?
Right. Some people attribute it to mental health problems. Cal's family said he was diagnosed with bipolar and schizophrenia disorders. He was released from a mental hospital a few months before the murder.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people question what's the difference between this case and other violence on BART where the victim is white and the accused is a person of color. They say those acts aren't always labeled hate crimes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, no matter the reason behind the attack, it's tragic.
So how is the community dealing with this tragedy?
There have been a lot of events for people to come together. I went to Voz en Tinta, a literary reading at Alley Cat Books in the Mission.
And what was going on there?
It was packed, Tana. Standing room only. The curators told me it was one of the most attended readings they've had. It was really, really heavy. And I spoke there at the event. But one of the moving performances from the night came from poet Thea Matthews. And here's a clip from her poem, She Lives.
She survives. You may not always see her. You may forget she even exists. But always know this. Each breath cries. Say her name. Say her name. Say her name.
So powerful.
Very.
So where else did you go?
Yeah, so that was in San Francisco, but most of these events have been held in Oakland. And I went to a sound healing circle for Black women and allies in Oakland.
Sound healing.
What is that? Sound healing. A singer and sound healer named Gina Breedlove hosted this circle. And she has a beautiful voice, very, very beautiful voice. And she says sound and vibrations can move blocked energy. Everyone stood in two circles holding hands, and the outer circle sang to the small inner circle of women. And the point was to send good energy to the hearts of those in the inner circle.
And we're sending them peace and love. We're sending them community. We're sending them, I see you. I feel what you feel. I love you. I got you. Right?
Janae, this is so very just deep and touching, even to somebody who's not there, who's just listening to it. How did the people react who were actually there?
It was beautiful and it was raw. Some people started wailing and holding each other, and we were in a very large studio. It was pretty full, Hana. And, you know, Black women don't always get that space for that kind of release. It was hard to record that. It was really, really hard because I knew, as a Black woman, I knew it was Nia Wilson, and I knew it was everything else going on. I knew, I felt people just the weight of changes of, you know, trying to pay rent, of just the climate right now, the racial climate in the country, and just other stories of violence in the city. So... and just, you know, just dealing with being with a Black woman every day in a society. It was heavy. It was heavy. I just recorded for a few minutes and just turned it off out of respect.
Yeah, I mean, that is very, like, deep, and it feels, like, personal for you, like, just being there. I know a couple of weeks ago you told me about this experience you had in Castro Valley while parking your car.
Yeah, so I was going to my aunt's 4th of July barbecue. And I was, as I was parking, an elderly white woman approached my car, and I was looking at her. She was looking at me, and I rolled down my window and I said, "Is everything okay?" And she said, "Who are you?" And I said, "Well, who are you?" And she said, "Well, I live in this neighborhood." I said, "Okay." I said, "And my aunt lives in this neighborhood, and I'm going to her barbecue. It's the 4th of July." And she was like, "Well, you shouldn't be parking here." And I said, "I can park anywhere I want. It's a public street." But I knew that was not just like, oh, you don't live in this neighborhood.
It's not just about parking.
Yeah, and it's not just about parking.
So at that circle then, did you feel that it was for Nia Wilson, but it was also for many women, including you, maybe?
Oh, yeah. I didn't, like I said, I didn't record long. And you could feel the weight. You know, you could feel the, I had never been in a, and I've been in spaces and retreats, but that I really felt the pain, you know, of what other women were experiencing. And then just some things I've experienced, you know, in this climate. Mm-hmm. It affects me, you know, me with my 2 degrees and, you know, my parents who have college degrees, it affects everyone. So I felt that. I definitely felt that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Janae.
Thank you.
Janae Darden is our Oakland reporter. You can reach her at janae@klw.org.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Our next story is the first in a series we're calling State of Change, looking at Californians and the natural world. And it takes us to the coast. Purple sea urchins are spiny underwater invertebrates that look like pincushions. They're native to the ocean along the California coast and share their home with sought-after delicacies like abalone and red urchin. Now, after a few years of rapid growth, some people are calling purple sea urchins a scourge. Claire Strempel takes us out on the water off the Mendocino coast with divers removing purple urchins by the boatload.
Go, guys. Ears on, rigging your mouth. Rig in your mouth. And whenever you're ready, you're good behind you.
It's just after 8 a.m. on a foggy morning. James Mosquito helps a boatload of divers in black neoprene wetsuits flip backwards off his boat. These divers will plunge down 30 feet into the cold water to scrape purple urchins off the bottom.
Okay, bars, bags. Okay, fix your mask. Hold on your mask.
Usually, divers on this cove are picking abalone, but today they're only taking purple urchins. Think of it like weeding for the ocean floor. Some are using their hands, others have improvised tools. One woman carries a yellow kitty litter scooper.
To scoop them and put them in the bag so I don't have to grab them with my hands.
Under our boat, there would normally be a lush forest of bull kelp, teeming with fish. Now the seafloor is carpeted in purple urchins. Having some urchins in a cove is normal, but this amount is out of control. They've eaten all the kelp that's a food source in the cove. Now even they are starving. But clearing purple urchins out of protected coves like this one could give kelp a chance to grow back. Back on land, I meet Matt Madison, one of the divers camping out this weekend. He looks like a working man's Neptune. Wetsuit open to the waist and all kinds of spears in the bed of his truck. He runs a spearfishing group.
So the situation that is going on out here is detrimental. It's the worst I've seen in 38 years of diving out here. I started diving when I was 6 from the Sonoma Coast and Mendocino Coast. So we got to do something.
For most of his life, the ocean floor has looked different.
I can remember the days where you come out here diving and you would have to struggle to find the holes to be able to dive in because there was so much kelp.
For the entire underwater ecosystem to switch from kelp forest to a wasteland of spiky urchin in just a few years is unnerving for people like Madison, who spend a lot of time underwater.
Majority, I would say probably 90% of our coast has lost its kelp resource. And it's not only affecting the abalone, it's affecting the whole fishery now. You got no life on the rocks. It looks like someone's pressure washed them with a pressure washer underneath there where before everything was just covered in life.
Purple urchins get painted as a bad guy here, but they're just the most visible sign that the ecosystem is unhealthy. In 2014, a huge blob of warm water weakened the bull kelp forest. On this part of the coastline, bull kelp is food for a lot of marine life. Purple urchins are fierce competitors for what's now a severely limited food supply. And if purple urchins eat it all, that means there's none left for the abalone. That's bad news for Blake Tillman, who owns the Fort Bragg dive shop his father opened 40 years ago.
Abalone diving is like been a main part of our business for years. Our numbers are way down, obviously.
Most years, Northern California has the largest recreational abalone fishery in the world. People come from all over to dive here. One study estimates that it's worth $44 million. But this year, the state says no one can dive for abalone. They've closed the season until 2020 to give the abalone a chance to grow back. Abalone are like canaries in a coal mine. They're one of the first species in the ecosystem to be affected by the kelp loss.
This year, I would say it's so dramatic. I'd say it's probably like 75% down as far as like people coming. Like, it's huge. It's pretty huge, but we offer other stuff at the shop, so that's kind of helping us.
Dive shops are more than places to buy gear. They're like the office water coolers of the diving community, hubs for news and gossip. While we're talking, a steady stream of divers comes in to fill up tanks.
I got a lot of friends that are business owners in town, and they're all definitely feeling it.
So diving tourism is slow, and commercial divers don't have work either. But one biologist says this glut of purple urchins isn't the end of the world. It's just a thing that happens really rarely.
This is just an alternative stable state.
Dr. Steve Lonhart is a kelp expert who works for the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. He's working with California Department of Fish and Wildlife to find solutions for kelp recovery.
So for me, this is something I read about in ecology textbooks and learned about as an undergraduate. And so basically, I'm getting to see something that others have seen in the past.
It's happened before, and in theory, this purple urchin ecosystem will flip back to normal.
There's a lot of political pressure and pressure from the public to try and do something to see if it's even possible to change some of these urchin-dominated systems back into kelp forests, likely, you know, ahead of schedule, because they will flip back. Just take time.
But water temperature fluctuations like the one that killed the kelp are likely to happen more often. They're part of climate change. And the diving community isn't satisfied with a theory. So they're also working with the state to see if purple urchin removal really works to revive the kelp.
You want to have a result that causes people to remain interested, because if you feel like you're part of a solution, you're more likely to keep doing it. If you feel it's going nowhere, then you're going to move on to something else. So having the fish and wildlife biologists associated with those is really important.
People like diver Matt Madison are willing to spend their weekends fighting to bring the kelp forest back.
There's a lot of battles in a war, and that's what this is.
It's a small hope, but enough that divers have come from all over the state to pitch in. Even a crew of nearly 100 divers looks small on the cove, and they're up against millions of urchins. So people with diverse interests are banding together. Commercial fishermen and recreational divers, who usually compete for ocean resources, are working towards a common goal.
The whole dive community come together, from abalone divers to spear fishermen to scuba divers to photographers to research divers. I mean, we've got every aspect of diving here participating in these events, which is just historic.
Out on the Gray Cove, a flotilla of volunteer boats bobs in the swell. They'll pull over 2 tons of urchins this weekend, almost 60,000. A tiny dent on the total population. But people here hope it's the start of a big change. Brightly colored kayaks paddle back and forth between boats and the dark heads of divers as they haul spiny bags from the bottom of the sea. On the Mendocino Coast, I'm Claire Strumpel for Cross Currents.
That's the first story in State of Change, a KELW series about Californians and the natural world. The next purple sea urchin removal event will be the weekend of September 29th and 30th in Sonoma County at Ocean Cove Beach. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Surf season is heating up, and not just for humans. Earlier this month, dogs from around California came to Pacifica to hang 10 in the 3rd annual World Dog Surfing Championships. KELW's Sarah Harrison caught up with one of last year's top dogs to find out more about this unusual sport.
Okay, so this is Abby's board. As you can see, it's a little bit thinner than most surfboards. This is the soft top. She's got a...
Michael Wee is showing me his dog Abby's custom board. It's got a unique fin alignment. He says it helps her steer better. It's also got a notch to hold a camera in place and a leash to keep it from getting lost in the waves.
It's just the top that's soft so that her claws can dig into it. And you can see here, there's a number of places where you can see her claws have dug in.
Abby's a 12-year-old Australian Kelpie and a champion dog surfer. She holds the Guinness World Record for longest wave surfed by a dog, a total of 60 meters. But Michael says he didn't have any of that fame in mind when he took her into the water 10 years ago.
Abby was a rescue dog and she was highly traumatized. So originally, going to the beach, swimming in the ocean, and eventually discovering surfing was an accident, was to help her build her confidence.
One day, while Michael and Abby were on a really long swim, he asked a surfer if she could rest on his board. As soon as she got onto the board, she stood up.
We pushed her into a wave, and she had a great time. So we did it again, and it was the most confident I had ever seen her.
Since then, Michael and Abby have become surf celebrities. Abby has sponsorships, a dedicated following on social media, and she's even made an appearance on Animal Planet. Despite all her success, Michael says Abby hasn't let it get to her head.
She's very laid back. She's very much a surfer at heart.
Last year, Michael entered Abby into the World Dog Surfing Championships, and she won. This year, she's back to see if she can defend her title.
Surfers, head down to the water's edge. Take your boards. Take your dogs. Head on down for the next dog, dog team.
The dogs and their owners paddle out while spectators pack onto Pacifica's Lindemar Beach. May Ahmed and her friends stand ankle-deep in the surf, craning their necks to see the first heat of small dogs head into the surf.
They take the dogs out, and you see the dogs get increasingly alarmed, especially if they're small.
May and her friends are Abby fans. They like the way she poses for pictures after her heats. Michael lets her jump up and rest her paws on his shoulders, and then they both mug for the camera. But May has her eye on another competitor, too.
Well, we've been a fan of Gidget. As he, I'm going to just show you his shirt. Picture is a very determined pug coming to shore, strapped in with a life vest, atop a bright pink surfboard.
Dog surfing is actually a pretty human-intensive sport. There are people in the water to pick the right waves and push the dogs towards shore. Then there's a team of people on land to make sure the dogs make it safely in. If there's a wipeout, a human is there to scoop the dog up and set it back on the board. Michael says while all the dogs are rivals on land, in the water, it's a different story.
If something happens, everybody jumps in and helps. It's a really great, safe community in the water. Everybody's friends, and on land, we're all out to get each other.
The competition is divided into categories for small, medium, and large dogs. There's also categories for human and dog tandem surfing. The dogs head out for 15-minute heats, and the judges assess their tricks and overall surf ability. Getting the dogs to shore seems to be the main objective. The judging is supposed to consider the size of the waves and the length of the ride, but to an untrained observer like me, it just looks like an uncoordinated melee with dogs and humans thrashing in the water. In the small dogs, Prince Dudeman and his owner Ryan Thor make it through, while others, like Rusty the Surfing Minpin, a miniature pincher, don't make the cut.
That was it for heat one of medium dog.
Abby.
Up
Abby,
next,
let's go.
Beans and Abby head on down.
Abby faces off against Beans the Whippet, but Michael's a little nervous. He broke his ankle the week before, and he's been slowed down by a big neoprene-wrapped cast. Plus, the surf is bad, and the water is cold. Abby only manages to catch a couple good waves. By the end of the heat, Michael looks exhausted, barely able to make it out for their signature pose.
Good job, Abigail. Good job. I think my leg kept holding me back a little bit. We got out as far as I thought we could, and Abby got one good ride.
Abby takes a nap under the judge's table and then charms her way to a bag of treats from some volunteers. She doesn't seem to notice that they haven't advanced to the finals.
Congratulations. So now we're down to the final, the top dog.
Golden Doodles Derby and Teddy bound to the water alongside their small and medium-sized competitors. All the dogs seem to have good runs. When the horn blows at the end of the heat, I think maybe Derby has surfed his way to top dog. But the big dogs are no match for Gidget. In the end, that determined pug on the pink surfboard takes home the prize. Abby and Michael cheer them on. Michael's disappointed they didn't advance, but he's still happy to walk away with third place in their category.
We had fun. That's what matters.
Michael encourages all dog owners to use sports to bond with their animals. Whether that's shredding it on a surfboard or running around with a frisbee, he says the most important thing is to find something you both enjoy.
Your relationship with your dog should be all about helping your dog find their true potential, what they're meant to be.
Abby is getting older, and Michael doesn't know how much longer she'll be able to compete. But he is confident that she'll always surf. He says, it's just what we do. In Pacifica, I'm Sarah Harrison for Cross Currents.
You can see pictures of all the furry competitors and their owners at klw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter so you stay informed about our take on what's happening around the Bay Area. Today's Cross Currents team includes Nina Gensler-Deb, Sarah Coast, Emma McAvoy, Miran Abulsi, Truk Nguyen, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rowlands and Gabe Graben, and a big, fat welcome to our new engineer, Tariq Foda. Our content manager is Shireen Adil, our managing editor is Jen Chien, and our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.